Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading from the November 2024 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. So I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article, The Living Memory of Blue Water. After the U.S. Army massacred a Lakota village, dozens of plundered artifacts ended up in the Smithsonian. It's written by Tim Madigan. To reach the place known as Minnethuwakpala, the Blue Water, you drive west from the Nebraska hamlet of Llewellyn, turning from Highway 26 onto a gravel road, and turning again through a gate that leads to fenced pasture land. The ancient cottonwood, now known by the Lakota Sioux as the Witness Tree, still towers above the grasslands. Blue Water Creek cuts a crooked path through a broad valley, its waters still pristine. On that hot, windy afternoon in September 2023, the first of my three recent visits, it was easy to imagine what had unfolded by that placid stream long ago. For the Lakota village of a leader named Little Thunder, the buffalo hunt in late summer 1855 had been particularly bountiful. Some 40 teepees, home to about 200 people, stood beside the water. Women would have been at work tanning hides for teepees, moccasins, shirts, and breeches, and drying and curing meat for the coming northern winter. Warriors would have seen to weapons and horses. Children would have been at their games. Old men would have gathered around the fires with their sacred chanyapas, their pipes, perhaps reminiscing about the days when the Wasatchu, the whites, were mere curiosities. Then, just after sunrise on September 3, 1855, 600 U.S. Army soldiers, commanded by Brigadier General William S. Harney, surrounded and ambushed the village, the first time in the Indian Wars of the Northern Plains that the military attacked a camp full of families. Today, the attack is often known, to the extent it is known at all, as the Blue Water Massacre. But for more than a century, it was remembered in a few conventional histories as a particularly ruthless U.S. military victory, the Army's first major salvo in a 35-year campaign against the Lakota, lords of the Northern Plains, the people of Red Cloud, Sitting Bull, and Crazy Horse, which ended finally with their subjugation at Wounded Knee in 1890. That episode, where as many as 300 Lakota were slaughtered, is widely known. The same cannot be said about Blue Water. The bloody chain of events had begun a year earlier, in mid-August 1854, when a lame-footed cow belonging to a Mormon settler wandered into the camp of the Brule, also known as the Sikangu, one of seven bands that make up the Lakota Nation. There, along the North Platte River in what is now Wyoming, the animal was felled by the arrow of a warrior named High Forehead, who may have been hungry. The Brule Lakota chief, Conquering Bear, hurried to nearby Fort Laramie and offered the Mormon a horse from his own herd as restitution. The matter might have ended there, were it not for the ill-fated ambition of Lieutenant John Grattan, a 24-year-old Army officer a year out of West Point. Grattan was determined to personally arrest High Forehead and make his reputation in the process. On August 19th, Grattan, with a drunken interpreter and a detachment of 29 soldiers, began a 10-mile march to the Lakota camp. Frontiersmen and other civilians they met along the way pleaded with the lieutenant to reconsider, as a small city of more than 4,000 Lakota had grown up by the North Platte. "I don't care how many there are," Grattan told them. "With 30 men, I can whip all the Indians this side of the Missouri." When Grattan and his men marched into the village, Conquering Bear tried to reason with him, but the young officer made clear he would not leave without his prisoner. "For all I tell you, you will not hear me," Conquering Bear finally said. "Today you will meet something that will be very hard." Surrounded by hundreds of Lakota warriors, a panicked U.S. Army soldier fired the first shot. Grattan and all but one of his men were swiftly killed. The last soldier eventually succumbed to his injuries. Grattan's body was riddled by 24 arrows. Conquering Bear, one of three Lakota who were wounded, died from his injuries several days later. News of the killings became an object of national outrage, though in the months to come, congressional and army reports placed the blame for what happened squarely on Grattan. That November, three Brule Lakota warriors, later identified as Spotted Tail, Red Leaf, and Long Chin, close relatives of the slain chief, attacked a mail coach traveling near Fort Laramie, killing three men, wounding a fourth, and reportedly making off with thousands of dollars in gold, an act of revenge per Lakota custom. By then, President Franklin Pierce and his Secretary of War, Jefferson Davis, had already endorsed a retributive expedition of their own against the Lakota. To lead it, Davis turned to Harney, an old friend who had experience fighting Native Americans in Florida and Wisconsin. In a White House meeting, Pierce gave Harney, a barrel-chested man with a long white beard, simple orders. "Whip the Indians," the president said. In August 1855, Harney and his men, equipped with new long-range Sharps rifles, set out from a frontier fort. "By God, I am for battle," Harney told a fur trapper as he departed. "No peace." By September 2nd, the troops were camped along the North Platte near a place called Ash Hollow, a popular stopping point for westward traveling immigrants on the Oregon Trail. Harney learned that Chief Little Thunder, who had succeeded Conquering Bear after his death, was camped about 6 miles north by Blue Water Creek, a tributary of the North Platte. Before sunrise the next morning, the general ordered a detachment of cavalry to skirt the village and take up a position to the north. The rest of the force would attack from the other direction, driving the Lakota villagers into the teeth of the waiting soldiers. A separate, smaller village of Oglala Lakota camped along the creek 3 miles north of the Brule, discovered the hidden cavalry, but by the time they did, it was too late. As soon as the Brule glimpsed Harney's troops, the women began to strike teepees, loading lodge poles, skins, and other belongings into travois, sledges drawn by horses and dogs. Seeing the people flee north, Harney feared his cavalry had insufficient time to set the ambush. To stall, he sent a guide to request a parley with Little Thunder. The chief quickly obliged, galloping toward the soldiers with two of his most renowned warriors, Spotted Tail and Iron Shell. According to one account, Little Thunder approached Harney holding an umbrella as a makeshift white flag. The conversation took place over a distance of 30 to 40 feet. The general shouted his outrage for the killings of Grattan and his soldiers and the murders of the three men in the mail coach robbery. "The day of retribution had come," Harney said. 30 minutes later, feeling delay was no longer necessary, the general sent Little Thunder back to his people. He gave his soldiers the order to open fire, then took up a viewing position atop a nearby hill. What happened next was documented in Army after-action reports, in the private letters and journals of American soldiers, and in interviews they gave late in their lives. There was also one recorded account from the perspective of a Lakota survivor, a woman named Kakawin, who was in her 40s at the time, and gave her testimony many years later to another Lakota woman named Susan Bordeaux Betteyun. The smoke of the battle blinded her, Betteyun wrote in her own memoir, with my own eyes. As she looked all around, she could see the soldiers galloping after groups of old men, women, and children who were running for their lives. Some were running across the valley, only to be met by soldiers and shot right down. As Kakawin tried to flee, a soldier shot her in the stomach. The bullet ripped her open for about 6 inches, a glancing shot. Her bowels protruded from the wound as she fell. To hide, Kakawin covered herself in tumbleweed and tore off a piece of her sleeve to use as a bandage. There she lay all day listening to guns roar and to the hoofbeats of the horses, the shouting and yelling of the soldiers who came so near at times that she thought she would be discovered. Once in a while she could hear a Sioux war cry. At these times, Kakawin said she felt like singing and giving the trill. Perhaps the most complete account of the massacre comes from the journal of a U.S. Army officer named Lieutenant Gouverneur K. Warren. The 25-year-old West Point graduate was a noncombatant, attached to Harney's expedition as a mapmaker and topographer. Apparently appalled by the brutality he witnessed, he devoted several diary pages to describing the day's horrors, particularly what he saw at Bluffside Caves, where many Lakota had sought safety. Soldiers giving chase fired indiscriminately into the caves, a barrage that went on until the cries of a child were heard from inside. Warren wrote, quote, wounded women and children crying and moaning, horribly mangled by the bullets. 2 Indian men were killed in the hole. 7 women were killed, and 3 children, 2 of them in their mother's arms. 1 young woman was wounded in the left shoulder. Another handsome young squaw was badly wounded just above her left knee, and the same ball wounded her baby in the right knee. I had a litter made and put her and her children upon it. I found another girl of about 10-12 years lying with her head down in a ravine and apparently dead. Observing her breath, I had a man take her in his arms. She was shot through both feet. I found a little boy shot through the calves of his legs and through his hams. He had enough strength left to hold me round the neck. End quote. Warren described his attempts to minister to the wounded and his distress at the sounds of a Lakota mother wailing for her dead baby. The feeling of sympathy for the wounded women and children and deep regret for their being so I found universal, Warren wrote. It could not be helped. The Lakota passed down other stories from that day across the generations. About the heroism of Spotted Tail and Iron Shell, for instance, who fought side by side against the soldiers. Greatly outnumbered, Spotted Tail was said to have killed several soldiers, despite being wounded himself by bullets and sabers. He survived and managed to escape. The story of a dying grandmother and one little boy, the son of the chief, became something of a legend among the Brulé. In 2005, exactly 150 years later, That story was recounted near the site of the massacre by the boy's great-granddaughter, a Lakota elder and activist named Rosalie Little Thunder. His grandmother's blood dripped on him, but he stayed still when he heard all the hoofbeats, gunshots, cries, and shouts, she said to a group of relatives and others who had gathered for a commemoration. He finally emerged after some silence. The army spotted him and gave chase. He ran until he got over a little hill and found a burrow surrounded by tall grass. He hid there and stayed there until just before daylight, when it's coldest and the dew forms. He emerged from there and started his trek 200 miles north to Sikangu country to take word of the massacre. When it was over, 86 Lakota had been killed, many of them women and children. 4 U.S. soldiers died. Harney confiscated teepees and buffalo meat for his expedition. The rest of the Lakota belongings were plundered or burned. Then the general marched 70 survivors, mostly women and children, some 140 miles across the grasslands to Fort Laramie. There he insisted that the perpetrators of the mail coach attack surrender. If they did not, Harney threatened to turn his captives over to the Pawnee, the Lakota's mortal enemy. That was why the warriors Spotted Tail, Long Chin, and Red Leaf trotted on their horses into Fort Laramie a few weeks later. They were dressed in their finest regalia and sang their death songs when they surrendered, expecting to die at the end of a Wasatchu rope. Instead, they were taken into custody and imprisoned at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. The next year, at the urging of the region's Indian agent, President Pierce pardoned the Lakota warriors. The bloody episode had divergent impacts on the Lakota. For some leaders, it was a radicalizing event, evidence that the government could never be trusted, that violent resistance was the only path to meaningful tribal autonomy. One such leader was Crazy Horse, who was a teenager in the Oglala village, a few miles north of the Brule camp, and who, coming upon the massacre site, saw firsthand its terrible aftermath. Scattered along the rocky slope were lodge rolls, parfletches, robes, cradle boards, and many other village goods, all trampled and torn and burnt, Crazy Horse's biographer Mari Sandoz wrote in 1942. And among these lay dark places that were blood and darker ones that were the dead of his people. The Lakota historian Victor Duville has written that the memory never left Crazy Horse, and many say he thought of Blue Water while leading the rout of Lieutenant Colonel George Custer at Little Bighorn in 1876. For other Lakota leaders, such as Little Thunder and Spotted Tail, what they saw of the government's cruelty and disproportionate firepower convinced them that their people's best, or perhaps only, chance for survival was negotiation and eventual peace. Spotted Tail was sure the Lakota could not win against the power of the Americans, his biographer George E. Hyde wrote. Spotted Tail would become the chief lieutenant and eventual successor of Little Thunder, who was also wounded in the massacre but survived. Sensing the ultimate futility of resistance, the two men prepared to lead their people down the path of peace and survival, a survival that included loss of their independence and a forced residence on reservations, the historian Paul N. Beck wrote in 2004. In March 1856, Little Thunder was forced to shake hands with Harney, who had summoned leaders of the 7 Lakota bands to Fort Pierre in South Dakota to dictate his terms for peace, essentially obedience and docility. In return, Harney released the prisoners he had taken at Blue Water. A period of relative quietude between the Lakota, some of their native allies, and the U.S. government ended in November 1864 when a U.S. military force attacked a Cheyenne and Arapaho camp near Sand Creek in Colorado, killing an estimated 230 people, most of them women and children. In the violent years to come, government promises to the Plains Indians were made and quickly broken. The Lakota and their allies won several military victories against the army, most notably at the Little Bighorn, but as the years passed, there was a sense of inevitability, culminating with the slaughter at Wounded Knee, which extinguished the last embers of armed Lakota resistance. Little Thunder died in 1879, having handed over leadership of the Brule to Spotted Tail in 1866, according to DeVille. He was shrewdly confident that his successor had the best qualification of securing his unfulfilled goal of accomplishing peace. I first came across the story of the Blue Water Massacre by accident in early 2023, while researching a separate historical project about the American West. In the brutality of the violence and in the event's bewildering obscurity, it immediately reminded me of another event, the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921, when hundreds of African Americans were killed by a white mob in that city's Greenwood community. In 2001, I published a book about the Tulsa Massacre at a time when few people apart from survivors or their descendants knew much about it. What happened in Tulsa, I learned, was not a historical anomaly. Immersing myself in that history not only inspired in me greater compassion for people from different backgrounds with different histories, but also gave me a more fulsome understanding of the origins of our nation's racial and social fissures. By the time I returned to the subject of the Tulsa Massacre on its 100th anniversary for a story in Smithsonian, the autocracy had become widely known, and perhaps not coincidentally, hopeful signs of racial reconciliation in Tulsa and elsewhere had begun to take hold. Native American history has its own infamous gaps, but in recent generations many difficult truths have bubbled to the surface of the nation's cultural awareness. D. Brown's 1970 landmark bestseller, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, revealed for a broad audience the sanitized nature of mainstream indigenous history. Even still, the events at Blue Water received a single sentence. The American Indian movement, which flourished around the same time, fought publicly and militantly for unfulfilled treaty rights and the reclamation of tribal lands. In more recent decades, scholars, writers, filmmakers, artists, activists, political leaders, and others, Native and non-Native, have filled in the picture more completely. They have highlighted the relatively overlooked history of the enslavement of Native Americans, for example, or challenged simplistic narratives about American colonial expansion to focus on the ways indigenous people helped shape this country's borders, history, and culture. Some of this work has broken through into popular culture. In just the past decade, David Graham's Killers of the Flower Moon, adapted into a movie by Martin Scorsese, publicized the true story of the Osage Nation's extraordinary wealth after oil was found beneath tribal land and the string of murders by white settlers intent on stealing that wealth. The Ken Burns documentary, The American Buffalo, traced how deliberate U.S. policy all but eradicated the once abundant animal, with disastrous effects on the Plains Indians. The theme was explored by the Ojibwe writer David Truer in his 2019 counter history, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. Without the buffalo, he wrote, the Plains tribes had little choice but to move onto reservations. The reservations might have been designed as prisons, but now they became places of refuge. In 2021, the Chippewa novelist Louise Erdrich was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for The Night Watchman, set on the Turtle Mountain Reservation in the 1950s, the latest of her celebrated books to draw from the realities of Native life and history. And the FX television series Reservation Dogs brought American viewers onto a reservation in the present day, following the sometimes comic, sometimes tragic travails of young Native Americans plotting their escape from reservation life for what they imagine is something better. And with that, I'm afraid we have run out of time today. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. The article I've been reading was titled The Living Memory of Blue Water by Tim Madigan. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. The article I read was in the November issue, 2024, of the Smithsonian Magazine. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed an article you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the Broadcast Info and Audio, and then click on Demand. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.